Iran announces the arrest of over 24 Takfiri terrorists in connection with the recent deadly terror attack on a holy shrine in the city of Shiraz. The Yemeni Ansarullah movement reacts to the visit of an American military delegation to Yemen, warning of US attempts to create tensions in the country. Also ahead, world leaders are gathering in Egypt for the UN climate summit COP27 amid calls for the rich countries to provide funding to other nations vulnerable to climate change. Hello and welcome to this hour's world news at our headquarters in Tehran. Many thanks for joining us. Iran's intelligence ministry says it has so far arrested 26 Takfiri terrorists in connection with the recent terror attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The ministry says the detainees are nationals of the Azerbaijan Republic, Tajikistan and Afghanistan. The ministry says the terrorist who coordinated the terror attack is a national of the Azerbaijan Republic. According to the ministry, some of the detainees were plotting to carry out acts of terror in various cities, including in the southeastern city of Zahedan. The ministry vowed its operation will continue until all people behind the incident in Shiraz are identified and punished. It saw a gunman enter Shah Cheragh Shrine and open fire on pilgrims, killing over a dozen and injuring another 21. Daesh terror group has claimed responsibility. Iran's defense ministry has unveiled the upgraded Bavar 373 long-range missile system and launched Sayyad B4 missile production line. Salman Khojouri reports.
Iran has unveiled the Bavar 373 missile system with a range of over 300 kilometers. Moreover, the Sayyad B4 defense missile production line was also inaugurated on Sunday in a ceremony attended by Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at the range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at the range of more than 300 kilometers.
Bavar 373 missile system has successfully hit targets at a range of 305 kilometers. This missile system has been designed to counter long-range targets, ballistic missiles, warplanes and bombers. Even many technologically advanced countries aspire to have such a high-tech missile system.
The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers.
The missile system has been totally produced and upgraded by Iranian specialists at the Defense Ministry and the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have been able to upgrade the range of this missile in only 2 years. This shows that we can counter all kinds of threats by using domestically made defensive equipment. As much as the threats advance, the Bavar 373 system and other air defense systems advance ahead of their current threats.
The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement height has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers. In the past couple of years, Iran has reached self-sufficiency in manufacturing different types of missiles to boost its defensive capabilities with the aim of protecting its territorial integrity and national sovereignty. Salman Khojouri, Tehran.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement warns that the US and UK are preparing for a fresh round of escalation in the Arab country. A senior Ansarullah official says several Western military delegations, including from the US, have visited Yemen over the past week. Ali Al-Qahoum made the comments in an interview with Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen news network. Meanwhile, according to Yemeni media, the U.S. delegations are focused on the Hadramaut province to access its oil. Ansarullah accuses Saudi Arabia, the UAE and their allies of plundering Yemen's oil and other natural resources. Recently, it launched a drone attack on a southern oil port. It said the attack was meant to deter attempts to steal Yemen's crude. Political activist and commentator Hossein al-Bukhaiti says the U.S. wants Saudi dominion over Yemen.
As the United States is stealing the oil from Syria for many years, they are actually doing exactly the same in Yemen. They wanted to fund the war on Yemen using Yemeni oil, despite the fact that Yemenis have not got their salaries in the public sector for about 5 years, because United States, with the support of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, has actually moved the central bank from Sana'a to Aden, and they want actually to have more pressure on Yemeni people. They want to force Yemeni civilians and Yemeni army to surrender to Saudi Arabia and Saudi and United Arab Emirates occupation. But as the Yemeni army has warned 2 weeks ago that if the Saudi Arabia were not totally lift the blockade, allow Yemeni to use their oil to pay salaries either in areas under the control of Sana'a or areas under the occupation of United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, that they will see more attack against Saudi Arabia.
U.S. forces have been accused of stealing tens of tankers filled with Syrian oil from the country's northeast. Local sources in Yoruba countryside say a convoy of more than 40 tankers loaded with crude from wells occupied by American forces in Hasakeh province left Syria through Mahmoudia crossing. They say the convoy entered neighboring Iraq later on. The development comes as the United States maintains its illegal presence in Syria despite objection from Damascus. Syria says the presence of U.S. forces there is aimed at tightening their grip on Syrian oil wells and looting the country's resources. World leaders are expected to meet in Egypt for COP27 climate talks, with emissions cuts and funding to fight global warming high on the agenda. Some 110 heads of states and governments are expected to participate in 2 days of UN talks in Sharm el-Sheikh. At the opening ceremony on Sunday, delegates agreed to discuss provision of funding to developing countries to fight the climate crisis caused by rich nations. Participating countries were also urged to adhere to their climate change obligations despite the financial crises they may be facing. The COP27 summit comes amid criticism that progress on curbing emissions has not been enough since the previous event in Scotland. We were joined earlier by historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling. Here is his take on the COP27 climate summit in Egypt.
Lots of money is going into this. If just a fraction of that was going to the United Nations, for example, which only meets for 5 days a year, I think we'd see a UN which was much more capable. So this almost seems to be one of the places where the world leaders come together, which is eclipsing the United Nations, rather like the World Economic Forum, because its budget is so much bigger. So there are 2 weeks there. We can plan to lessen pollution, but we shouldn't be trying to come up with a market solution. This market solution is simply a playing games, a kind of casino way of doing it. We just have to say, no, we have to do less of this. So there's also some controversy about to what extent climate change is being man-made, what extent the sun and other things have an effect on it. I think, you know, for me, I'm pretty clear that man does have quite a big effect on the climate. But there are a lot of scientists that contend with this, and the mass media, certainly in Britain, shuts them out of the discussion, shuts them out of the debate. And for example, back in 2013, we heard the scientists themselves at the IPCC, the UN body that's responsible for all this, saying that the average temperature hasn't risen for the last 15 years, and we're going to have to massage our report in order to try and make out that it has.
Welcome to the news review section of our programme. Anger is simmering over Italy's refusal to let in migrants plucked from the sea. A German rescue charity organisation says it will take legal action against the Italian government for violating international law. The organisation says it will file a petition in court in two Italian cities of Rome and Catania. That after Italy barred around 200 migrants to get off a rescue ship in Catania. Prior to that, Italian authorities let in 144 vulnerable passengers on board a German-flagged vessel while refusing to accept others. Those allowed to disembark were children and the sick. The ship was then ordered to leave the port city of Catania. Italy is now facing criticism for its selective approach towards receiving migrants. Human rights groups have called on Rome to stop discrimination. They say the law of the sea requires that all rescued migrants should be disembarked in a safe place. Joining us for this news review discussion is Max Civili and Peter Koenig, geopolitical analyst from Geneva. Gentlemen, thanks to the both of you for joining us. I really appreciate it. Max, I'll start with you. Please give us an update on the situation of the migrants in the Gulf of Catania.
Well, the standoff between the government and charity ships trying to disembark refugees in the port continues. A decision on the issues, as you mentioned before, will be taken by administrative courts as the charity ship Humanity will appeal against a decree issued by the Italian government, which allows only women, children and ill people to disembark. So far, 315 asylum seekers of 572 have managed to leave the rescue boat Geo Barents. Frankly, I don't understand why everybody's so surprised about what's happening in the port of Catania and about the attitude of Italy's far-right government, which is simply the flip side of the coin of EU's tough, inhuman migration policies. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni had said in several occasions, even during the electoral campaign, she made clear that she wants to reverse Italy's already shrunken humanitarianism on refugees. She clearly said she wants to set up a naval blockade to prevent asylum seekers fleeing Libya. So the fact that Giorgia Meloni has issued a decree which allows only women and children and ill people to disembark should not really come as a surprise. Having said that, we should also look at EU's responsibilities and Italy's previous center-left government's responsibilities. They set up a horrific system through an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government that basically keep the refugees stuck in Libyan horrific detention centers.
Absolutely. Peter, over to you. We have been aware of the structural flaws within EU's migration policies. Can we say it has been exacerbated with the rise of right-wing politics within EU governments, in this case Italy and its new right-wing administration?
Yes and no. Thank you first for having me. But yes and no. This is a very complex situation, this refugees. The European Union, I think we have to really take a few steps back and look at what's behind it and has been behind it for many years. The European Union, on the one hand, they say, well, it's a human rights abuse if a country doesn't accept refugees from North Africa and from Asia, from poor countries. Well, yes, but on the other hand, we have to see also who is behind the organization of these refugees. Many of those organizations are NGOs, and most of them are European NGOs. As was mentioned, the ship that unloaded some of the refugees was a German-flagged ship. So, you know, it's not even refugees, NGOs from the countries of where the refugees come. And there's a lot of money behind of all of this. This is one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that the European Union is hell-bent to destroy itself. And this sounds like an oxymoron, but refugees is a dividing factor because the World Economic Forum and the United States, they cannot use for the One World Order a group of people, you know, a community of 27 countries whose GDP is higher than the one of the United States. So there, anything to divide this bloc is good. And one of the big dividers are the refugees. Now, the right-wing government of Giorgia Meloni, she has said from the beginning, and your correspondent in Rome acknowledged that too, that Italy will accept people who have health issues and pregnant women, but not necessarily all the others. And I think Greece is about in the same league, and Portugal too, and maybe soon Spain, because they're all unloaded on these southern countries. They weaken them more because handling refugees it has a high cost. And the northern European countries, they do not contribute to that, or at least not enough. So it's all on the shoulders of Italy, Greece, Portugal, Spain, and with very, very little contribution from northern countries. And the issue behind it is, again, you know, these countries, and especially those that are right-wing, considered right-wing countries, in the case of Italy, it's clear, I mean, there's no dispute that Giorgia Meloni belongs to the, to a very right-wing party. But the right wings, and this is what irks the European Union, the people in Brussels, and those who are globalists, and the World Economic Forum and Washington, is they are not globalists. Mm-hmm. These right-wing governments, they are nationalists, and they do not want to have anything to do with globalism, which is trying to take over the world. And so anything that counts, I know I'm not talking very much about the refugees right now, but the refugees are an instrument in this destabilizing these countries. So I think we have to look at it from different aspects. Look, for example, the other controversy is they apply double standards. The Ukrainians, some of them are very rich people, not all, of course, very many are poor. But the refugees from Ukraine, they are led into these countries, they are welcome, they get anything they need and that they want.
Absolutely. Thank you so much to the both of you gentlemen for joining us. Peter Koenig from Geneva, geopolitical analyst, and Max Civili from Rome. Thanks to the both of you. And on that note, we've come to the end of our news review programme.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
The UK has a new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. He has promised to get things in order, although his tone is reserved in how he can do that, especially given the economic storm that the UK is facing. Will he be able to turn things around, or is it too much to handle for Sunak? Hi, I'm Kavitha Wei. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, first we take a look at Sunak himself. 42 years old, 7 years in politics only, but what is standing out? His estimated fortune, £730 million, or $830 million. Can he connect with the average Brits? Next up, Sunak's economic plans, but not too fast. His economic agenda, somewhat hazy, based on how it's been described. Most likely higher taxes, which he has introduced, and along with that, reduced spending. Big question is, will that be enough? Next up, some of the traits of the UK economy, negative ones. Inflation, looking at food, mortgage and energy. Poverty, 22%, and of course the recession. We'll find out whether Sunak can deal with all of that or not.
After lots of drama, the UK now has a new Prime Minister.
But some mistakes were made. Not born of ill will or bad intentions. Quite the opposite, in fact. But mistakes, nonetheless. And I have been elected as leader of my party and your Prime Minister, in part, to fix them.
The UK's cost of living crisis started in 2021, with essential good prices increasing faster than household revenues. The result was a sharp fall in real incomes. With inflation running at 10% for now, predicted to reach even highs of 20% or more, the UK consumer confidence remains at an all-time low. Consumers face a tighter economic squeeze in 2023 after Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt scrapped tax cuts planned by former Prime Minister Liz Truss. He also scaled back her vast energy support scheme for households.
Social media posts about this topic is pretty evident in terms of all eyes being on Sunak and what he is going to do. At the same time, there are many who are very pessimistic about whether he's able to make sure that the UK economy is not going to actually go through a downfall, not that it hasn't. So let's take a look at some of the media posts. First up, we took a look at this one from himself, where he said, "I will unite our country, not with words, but with action. I will work day in and day out to deliver for you." Okay, the man himself. The economic cost of Brexit is our next post, where it said, "We're masked by the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine. But 6 years after the UK voted to leave the EU, the Brexit effect has become clear. And in this film, we examine how Brexit hit the UK economy." Our next post, "The war did not destroy the UK economy. Liz Truss didn't destroy the UK economy. Shutting down the economy for months on end and printing £500 billion in quantitative easing during this period destroyed the UK economy. Also, it's a global economic crisis, not just a UK one." Our next post, "Britain has been living beyond its means since about the year 2007. Several other countries, such as the US, also live beyond their means. You are right. Final straw and long overdue crisis was printing of billions in currency by many governments to support their economies during COVID." Then, a stark reality, the 6 richest billionaires in the UK have as much money as the poorest 13.2 million, with 3 million more who are about to be pushed into poverty. The 6 should pay, not the 16 million. Wealth taxes, not cuts. All right, those were the posts that we picked. Let's introduce our guests for this edition of the Q&A. First up, Niall McRae joins us. He's the officer of the Workers of England Trade Union. Niall McRae, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at the United Kingdom and the rest of the Europe, for that matter, they are facing not a good year. You have inflation worries, the recession fears, and, of course, you have the high energy costs. You have the stimulus that, in the case of the UK, is set to be over £550 billion. And the UK performing the worst out of the G7 countries. Why is the UK at the bottom of the list there, do you think?
Well, of course, the UK and the European Union is blaming this all on Russia. They're blaming it all on Vladimir Putin and the conflict in Ukraine. But these inflationary pressures existed long before the Russian tanks rolled into Ukraine. It's got worse since the war in Ukraine started. But that's partly because the EU and the UK have imposed sanctions on Russian oil and gas and other Russian produce, which has exacerbated the problem of inflation. But the inflation problem was already there because of the quantitative easing, because of the vast printing of money for these incredibly profligate COVID measures, such as in the UK, we had this track and trace system, which cost billions of pounds. And then the huge expenditure on the contract with Pfizer and other vaccine manufacturers, the cost of furlough, you know, of workers being taken out of the workplace, but on government-assisted pay. And the whole COVID-19 regime was extremely expensive.
Okay. Gilbert Doctorow is our next guest who joins us for this part of the QA. He's an independent international affairs analyst. Gilbert Doctorow, welcome. Even before the complications that the UK is experiencing, it was very vulnerable because it was looking at an economy that was not doing well, especially after Brexit. And of course, the trade with other European countries decreased. Some analysts have even stated the UK never recovered from the 2008 financial crisis. Is that the case? Do the economic problems of the UK go that far back?
United Kingdom, again, as I said, was caught in the middle of these serious challenges that have a continental-wide and European and global impact. And it was in a transition period which left it unprepared to respond adequately to the challenges arising in its relationship, trading relationship with Europe. Because the Brexiteers and the government of Johnson and then his successor have been ideologues and have been inflexible and have sought to achieve the maximum results from their break with Europe at the expense of everyday business, commerce, and welfare of the economy, Britain has suffered from disruptions. The insistence of the British leadership to resolve the questions over trade with Northern Ireland have been have exacerbated relations. The position of Britain with respect to refugees crossing the Channel and to the support that refugees have received in northern France from where they have traveled by boat to UK also has been a sore point and an irritation in relations at the very moment when Britain is very much in need of better trade relations to face the challenges of the of inflation and disruption of supply chains.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program. This is where we take economic news from around the world and present it to you. Hopefully, the ones that we have picked is of interest to you. First up, we're going to take a look at an issue that is a problem for the EU, and that is spending as a whole. We're taking a look at most EU residents who are unfortunately in a reduction of spending mode, and that's on basic essentials. The percentage is around 71%, of which EU consumers have been forced to change their shopping habits in order to keep food on the table. That is how bad things are turning out for the EU. People are eating in more and buying cheaper food. Reasons are many. The Ukraine conflict, obviously, is one of them. Next up, we go to the U.S. and take a look at the U.S. consumer confidence in terms of Americans in that country. Well, it has taken a hit for the month of October. It has fallen from 102.5 to 107.8, or it has fallen to 102.5. The prior month was 107.8 in September. Now, the reasons for that, inflationary pressures are continuing to be a drag on the confidence of Americans and their spending. And this comes at a sensitive time because it's before the holiday season. So we have to wait and see whether the holiday season is enough to stimulate Americans to go out and spend money. Next up, EU sanctions that has occurred. And this is a topic that we picked because it was very interesting, the response that was given by the person that was sanctioned. The sanctioned person is a high-ranking Iranian general. His response, he has mockingly told the EU, who has placed the sanctions on Iran and this Iranian general, he has said to the EU to buy coal with his assets. And the person sanctioned, Major General Mohammad Bagheri. He was sanctioned for allegedly supplying Russia with drones. He has warned Europeans that a difficult winter is ahead. Of course, this is something, an allegation that has not been proven and Iran has denied. Next up, let's take a look at China's economy. Obviously, we have to wait and see how China's economy is going to evolve based on the sensitive situation. But for now, the GDP growth has rebounded at a faster pace for Q3, but the risks loom based on the economic environment. Official data has shown that China's GDP rose 3.9%. This would be for the span of July through September, quarter year on year. Those were the topics that we picked. That's all the time we have for that.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Rishi Sunak, the new Prime Minister, has a lot on his hands. And how he will bring the UK out of this economic quagmire is not really known. Let's look at some of the challenges that he is facing. One of the main issues that the UK is facing, and it has become more prominent after COVID-19, is labour shortage. The UK workforce has shrunk 1.2% since COVID-19 hit, coming in at number two, as evident among advanced economies. In terms of the shrinkage, obviously that's not good news. Now, another reason for the labor shortage is trade overall and the impact of Brexit. The UK trade openness has fallen more sharply than other advanced economies since Brexit. Here, the percentage change in trade in goods and services as a share of the GDP from 1 in 2017 to Q4 in 2021 is seen, and the UK has come in last. Next up, UK productivity. It has also been impacted by two major factors, you guessed it, Brexit and COVID-19 pandemic. The drop that has occurred based on when the referendum on the EU membership took place and, of course, when then COVID-19 hit. After that, the productivity, when it hit, it did not really catch up to the pre-pandemic levels when it began to rise. Now, another major issue is broken supply chains. That has continued to plague not just the UK, but the entire EU, for that matter. Now, one that we picked is the availability of cooking oil. Of course, the Ukraine conflict has also had an impact on a host of items, but the cooking oil is something that is of major concern for the UK in terms of the shortage, and that's based on the supply chain. Now, out of all the G7 countries, the UK has experienced the worst, or should I say, the lowest economic growth. Even though the percentages are very close, but overall, the UK is the lowest. All of them, however, fall below 5%. Now, it may surprise many, but poverty is a major problem in the UK. 14.5 million people, that's right, 14.5 million people of the total UK population are actually in poverty. That's 22% of the population. In terms of the breakdown, 8.1 million to be working age adults, 4.3 million who are children, and 2.1 million are pensioners. That's something that the UK needs to be worried about with this new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. And then rounding off the list is inflation, the UK inflation rate, the highest that it has seen in 40 years. And that's no laughing matter. I mean, the last time we checked the inflation rate, it came at, this is again, is the highest in 40 years. That number is 10.1% going up through January 2022. And at this point, it has peaked at around 10.1%, and it is projected to get even higher. We just listed some of the challenges that Rishi Sunak will be facing. Let's bring back our guests and get an idea from them of what he can do about it. Niall McRae is the Officer of the Workers of England Trade Union who rejoins us. Niall McRae, welcome back. The UK and its citizens are facing a cost of living crisis that you do know, I'm sure. Supply chains, as we just mentioned, are one of the biggest challenges that Rishi Sunak has to face. This is while we're looking at the high cost of energy, the UK being in a recession, which have made matters obviously worse overall. Is Sunak ready to tackle all of this, in your opinion?
I have my doubts. The Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, I regard him as a globalist. I believe that he was installed by the World Economic Forum. I believe he was installed by the World Economic Forum, the Prime Minister. He's from an extremely rich family background in India. His father-in-law runs a company called Infosys, which is heavily involved in making digital identity systems. So Rishi Sunak is very ensconced with the World Economic Forum, and I believe that he will take his instructions not from the British people, but from what the globalist forces want him to do. And I'm not only talking about the financial masters of the universe. I'm also talking about the military project of the New World Order, which is to weaken Russia, to continue this fight in Ukraine, and to pour more and more money into this battle, and to make sure that there's no peace deal, because they want this to go on, because they want to deal with Russia first.
All right. Well, let's see what Gilbert Doctorow thinks. He's an independent international affairs analyst who rejoins us. Gilbert Doctorow, taking a look at what Rishi Sunak is facing is obviously a huge challenge for him. I'd like to find out from you whether he's really up for this, whether he can deal with the challenges ahead, or which is so multifaceted given the bad state of affairs that the UK is in compared to the rest of the G7 advanced economies.
Let's be open about it. Mr. Sunak is a very pleasant change from the aggressive, abrasive Truss who preceded him. He is not an ideologue. She was. He is a more pragmatic man, necessarily given his background in international finance and his work as an international banker. However, the challenges are immense, and he has insufficient experience in government to cope with them adequately. He has a limited circle of supporters and advisors whom he has brought with him into government. They also are not the people to deal with these crushing problems and challenges that Britain faces.
Even before the current political and economic mess, the UK was in a vulnerable position. The country is still reeling from the aftermath of Britain's exit from the Eurozone, which has come to be known as the post-Brexit crisis. Some believe the UK never managed to recover from the post-Brexit economic turmoil. Many Tories now believe that the UK economy is doomed without Brexit renegotiation. There are some that even say that the UK should discard Brexit. But the current political mess in the UK has compounded its long-standing problems. Some business owners now believe the investment in the UK remains elusive.
Labour thinks that we should be having a general election. I think everybody who I've spoken to, the public, have said we should be having a general election. There is no mandate now. The Conservatives have completely broken their promises, broke our economy, and now they want to see a general election. They can't just keep doling out prime ministers every month because they're in total chaos and they've lost control of the market and haven't got any ideas of how they're going to tackle the cost of living that people are facing.
Because of the uncertain political and economic climate hovering over the country. Like the rest of Europe, UK citizens are in economic hardship. In September of this year, 45% of adults in the UK who paid energy bills were finding it very or somewhat difficult to afford them, up from 40% in June. Some 30% of those paying rent or mortgages reported it being difficult to afford, up from 26% in the same frame. More than one in five of the UK population lives in poverty. That's 14.5 million people. Of those, 8.1 million are working-age adults, 4.3 million are children, and 2.1 million are pensioners. According to surveys, more than 2 million adults in the UK cannot afford to eat every day. And one in seven adults is estimated to be food insecure.
Mm-hmm.
We have been telling you in this program how bad the situation is with the UK economy. Now, we want to review how much it actually costs an average Brit to live in the UK, taking into account the average salary. We've taken many of the latest data available to analyze this. This is broken down to three categories: only one parent working full-time, one part-time, and two parents working full-time. In the case of one parent working, there is a deficit £910, which means that income falls short. With one working full-time and one part-time, only £324 are left to spend each month, only if both work is there an adequate amount left to spend. The costs of domestic fuel, food and drink, as well as social and cultural participation, have seen the biggest increases in costs. The rising costs has hit all groups as seen here, taking things like food and drink and clothing into consideration, with fuel locking in the biggest percentage increase. These figures do not include the cost of rent and childcare, which would see the weekly sums skyrocket further yet. Even though it's becoming increasingly difficult to reach the minimum standard of living, things have taken a turn for the worse, like when it comes to electricity, something the former PM, Liz Truss, said she would fix but failed to put into action.
And now is the time to focus on delivering, making sure that we are delivering on our energy package. So before we stepped in, people were facing energy bills of up to £6,000.
And in terms of mortgages, this so-called mini-budget threw that into a turmoil. Record number of UK mortgage deals were pulled in one day as a market mayhem took hold. Hundreds of residential mortgage deal offers were pulled. HSBC, Santander and NatWest were the latest major lenders that paused or changed their offerings. This led to concerns about mortgage rates becoming unaffordable have spiked as fears of base rate rising to 6% next year spread, something which is in a state of flux.
The reaction to the mini budget was that financial markets were unconvinced largely by what the Chancellor had said, and so we saw 7 days of fairly notable volatility on financial markets, which meant that mortgage lenders had to pull their products so they couldn't price them. And so mortgage availability has gone down. It's likely to be temporary, but it's gone down. But at the same time that's gone down, expectations for where mortgages are going to go have gone up.
And finally, food rounds off the list of the big three items, namely energy, mortgage and rent, and food, in which there has been record numbers going to food banks to survive.
We have people coming in all the time telling us that they work, both two people in their household work, but actually, you know, their rent has gone up, the council tax has gone up, gas and electricity, as we all know, are going up, and actually just the household income isn't sufficient to be able to cover things like food at the moment.
I basically worked for the NHS for the last, 17 years, and it is still a struggle, even though I'm worked like 33 hours a week.
OK, that's the end of this part of the show.
The UK economy is set to get worse before it gets better. That's the unfortunate reality that Rishi Sunak has to face. But the real question remains, is he going to be able to improve the state of affairs that's in the UK? We still don't know his economic plans, really. As of the recording of this program, we understand that he's going to go through spending cuts. £50 billion is what he has said. Of course, that's on top of the fact that he is probably going to go through increasing taxes. Now, if you take a look at those two scenarios, that's based on projections. And in terms of projections, how can you even do that given the economic climate that the UK is facing? Because there's so much instability when it comes to the host of things that we covered in this program. However, hopefully he can get to a point that he can actually go through with an action plan that will spell an improvement for UK's economy. That does it for this edition of the program. It was really great having you with us. I hope you enjoyed it. Let me cover it that way. It's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Previously, we were looking at one of the causes that, you know, makes human beings kill each other, that makes people have wars, that destroy societies, basically, and that was greed, al-hirs. When people become greedy, they tend to forget that there are other human beings. They just want to have everything themselves, and they want to hoard everything themselves. And in the process, oppress other people if they have to, in whatever shape or form they can. So sometimes me and you, we wonder, how do people become greedy? And how do systems become greedy? Now, one of the simplest answers to this is that upbringing and education. When a person's upbringing is wrong, then he will tend to do the wrong thing. When the educational or the education system falls and it's weak, it will produce these kind of people. Education today, in the modern day, in pretty much, I can say, all countries, if not, let's say, most countries, if not all the countries, it's an education based on greed, an education that wants people to become greedy. What people and students learn these days in school, they learn how to get a job when they get older. That's it. You go to school, primary, you know, to begin with, and you got secondary college, and then you go to high school and university just so you can end up with a certificate that allows you to work and make money. Now, I'm not saying, obviously, it's all bad, but the initial idea of it is not to improve the human being or to make him a better human being. Rather, is to make a worker out of him. That is one of the main purposes and goals. And either a person makes it and he becomes something and then he can make money, or no. So when the education system falls and fails, it will produce plenty of greedy people. People that just care about themselves. People that will learn just so they could make as much money as they can without having to worry about other people. They worry about themselves only. So when it comes to the fitrah of human beings, the way Allah created them, it was clean. It was pure. So the hadith says, كُلُّ مَوْلُودٍ يُولَدُ عَلَى الْفِطْرَةِ. Every newborn is born on this clean, pure, innate. وَإِنَّمَا أَبَوَاهُ يُهَوُّدَنَهَا وَيُنَصَرَنَهَا. It's up to the parents to make him a Jew or a Christian or even a Muslim. So the education and the upbringing is what makes people think like that. If the education system tries to teach people to become better human beings, to become giving human beings, to teach people to share, to teach people to look after one another, to be a doctor so to save humanity, not so as a lofty position so you could make a lot of money. so you can become an engineer, so you can help build houses for those who are poor, not so you can have a name tag and people, you know, build skyscrapers or whatever they call them, just so you can make money or more money. If the education system makes you things like that, then it has definitely failed. Let us take a short break and then we will come back.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So we were saying that people become greedy because of their upbringing or the education system they go through. Another reason that makes people greedy is that their ideology is wrong, or doubts come in their ideology. When they don't find answers to some of their doubts in regards to religion, in regards to the afterlife, in regards to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they say, hey, I lived this life once, might as well enjoy it in any means possible. Even if it means I have to take the rights of other people, I don't care. Because there is nothing that I should be aware of or afraid of. There is no God to judge me. There is no one to, you know, ask me why. I'm free. So when the ideology of people is corrupted, greed will happen. When Islam came along, the first duty of Islam was, in fact, to correct the ideology of people, because the people of Quraysh or the people of Mecca back in the day, they were greedy people. They were extremely greedy. They were greedy in the sense that would enslave other people. They were greedy in the sense that would give loans with so much high interest that the person will not be able to pay it back. And what they would do is they will take one of his sons as interest or as a repayment for their interest or for the loan that they gave. Now, that is really bad. Why? Because the mentality and the ideology is based on wealth and having more wealth. The more wealth you have, the more powerful you are. Even if you have to enslave people, even if you have to kill people, even if you have to do the worst actions possible. So when Islam came, Islam said, first and foremost, change the way you think. Change your ideology. So ideology here plays a big role in terms of making people better people. The more we adhere to the Islamic teachings, the more we adhere to the teachings of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam, the better we are as human beings. The more we stay away, the greedier we become, the more sinful we become, the more aggressive we become, the more transgressive we become. So everything bad basically will happen. Why? Because our ideology is wrong. When I try to justify for myself taking the wealth of other people or the right of other people, that means there's something wrong with my ideology. And sometimes, mind you, you would have Muslims who are practicing on the other side, and they, you know, say we are Muslims, and they adhere to, you know, apparently to the teachings of the Quran and the teachings of Islam. But in reality, it's just a name. It's just a cover. But you see them becoming in positions and power, where if you look at some Muslim countries, where they are depriving their own people from their own resources, from the things that belongs to people, they're not giving it to them. So what's the point of Islam here? So ideology need to be corrected. Me and you, we have to constantly revive and renew our ideology and make sure it is sync or in sync with the Islamic teachings, or the teachings of the Quran, the teachings of the Ahl Bayt alayhim salam, so we don't deviate and in the process harm our fellow human beings. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.